I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey everyone, it's Raghu back with Mind Rolling and with the originator alongside of myself of Mind Rolling, David Silver. Thanks, David.
Me.
It's you. And David came up with a phenomenal idea. We have a whole new series in mind. But before I get into that.
No, I didn't. You did.
What?
It's your idea.
No.
I agree with the idea. I do, but, you know.
Okay. I thought it was your idea. It was your idea. I'm talking about Trump or Rinpoche, right?
Oh, yeah. That
was
your
idea.
Yeah.
The rest of it is spurious, and that'll be my idea, but I'll tell all about that in a second.
We can live with that idea.
Yeah, right. But anyhow, this is just before. This is a little ad, Dave, right? We got to. I don't know if you know about this. So there's a new Ram Dass book that's coming out in a few weeks, like around when this podcast comes out. So everybody, you can take a look for it. It's called Words of Wisdom from Ram Dass. And it's a book that was our friend Rachel here, who has been with the foundation for 10 years, Rachel Fisher. Many of you may know her if you're on the ramdass.org mailing list, which you should be because we always offer all sorts of great things. That's in my hat as the director of that foundation. And so the Words of Wisdom book is sectioned off by theme, so you can actually just have it hanging out or in the morning just go somewhere, okay, I got to think about how to deal with suffering or how to be a little bit more mindful today. So Ram Dass has, you know, across the board, so many great, and these are beyond just a couple of line quotes. They're like get into paragraphs, so they're substantial. So it's a really, really amazing, amazing book that I'm glad we're putting out in the 50th anniversary of Be Here Now and Ram Dass's second anniversary after he left. So I want everybody to know that. Also, Dave, we're starting a new a psychedelic podcast, which will be a first, with Madison Margolin. I'm not sure if you met her at one time, and she is the co-publisher and founder of this it's a couple of years, 2-3 years old psychedelic magazine, whose name escapes me in this moment. I'm so sorry, Madison. But go to Madison Margolin, and she'll be on the Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com and go to ramdass.org. You can pre-order that book and get a bunch of copies to give away this Christmas Hanukkah. That's it, Dave.
No, you do that very well.
Good commercial,
Well, you know, somebody has to pay for this stuff. And quite benign in the way you present it. At least you're not, you know, screaming.
Yeah, right. Well, like Crazy Eddie selling stereos.
No, I was thinking of Joan Namath, who does some kind of Medicare thing on TV these days. And it's so weird for me to see Joan Namath, you know, so flogging a it's a good thing. It's a Medicare thing you should know about if you're on Medicare. And he, you know, he does it. Mm. When I came to America, he was the guy that
won the Super Bowl.
Won the Super Bowl and called it. Now, I didn't know anything about NFL, nothing, zero. So when this guy, who was in New York, called it and said, we're going to win this, the Jets, which now is inconceivable. Yeah. I thought that's what they do. They call it and then they win it, you know, because he won it, but never happened again. It just shows you the power of positive thinking.
Yeah.
Which brings us to our subject.
No, actually, it brings us to, it brings me to think about Aaron Rodgers because of what just happened. But the complexity of it for us is he is a big Ram Dass fan. He put Ram Dass's book in his monthly book club, Be Here Now, and he got on the air on some radio show and just, you know, they were trying to make fun of him. Ram Dass, what's that? You know, a conservative thing. And he said this had really positively affected him in his life. And he was, so we were like, wow, isn't that so great? We love, you know, Aaron Rodgers is a football player. He's incredible. Then, of course, the COVID tribal beat came into this, right? Mm. And his kind of, shall we say, maybe not so factual rendition. I mean, he would say it was that he was immunized. He didn't say vaccinated. He said immunize, and then said some other things. The NFL's in it. So he was Me Too, or it's not me, cancel cultured immediately.
His took sponsors about an hour
gone. Yeah. They took, you know, one was a health thing and one was an insurance thing or something.
Yeah,
gone.
Yeah,
can you imagine? I mean, without, I mean, that is like whoa. This is quite a society we're living in related to media and information, disinformation, all of it, cancel culture, Me Too, all of it. It's really pretty amazing.
Yes. Yes, it is. And if you're listening to this in the near future or even in the distant future, I hope the prevailing atmosphere amongst the community of citizens is far less abrasive and actually, you know, downright dark. And we were living through that now for a while. Mm. But, you know, I sort of believe that mankind and decency prevails eventually, but it sometimes goes through these horrendous byroads of sort of, I don't know, hatred and the stuff that we
tribalism.
All know. Yeah. Tribalism. We all know increased. It doesn't work. It just doesn't work. Particularly if you've been in any kind of interdependence mindset, as we all pretty much have our whole lives. Those of us that are old enough to remember the 60s and how the psychedelic movement then fused into the deep involvement with Eastern philosophy, mysticism, practice, and so on, and devotional yoga. And we just, I mean, the idea of this development happening of tribalism and complete separation for no good reason of human beings, and then the sort of manipulation of that propaganda wise, and then it kind of curling in on itself and getting bigger and bigger because the propaganda is believed.
Yeah,
and if people, you know, and there is a connection with the book we're going to talk about, Raghu and I.
Yeah, total connection.
Yeah,
course,
there is a real connection. Absolutely. In terms of well, yes. Yeah, which, you know, we can get to. I mean, if you want to, or we can talk about something different for a while or whatever you want to do. We haven't done this for a while.
Let's get to the important stuff, like now.
Sure.
Well, I mean, the truth is, of course, with this increase in tribalism and this just phenomenal stress that we are all under in one way or the other on a day-to-day basis with what is going on in the world, in the country, with the pandemic, with racial justice, all of it. And so it's here's the good news, so to speak. It's manifesting where we can see what the Buddhist call the 16 billion impediments to our becoming whole, where we are kinder, where we're hopefully aspiring to be bodhisattvas, those who whose wish for becoming free is based on the wish to help, continue to help as many people as possible. So this manifestation of all of these, what they're called is kaleshas, impurities, from anger, greed, all of it, attachment, is come so visibly in front of us now. Nobody can deny it. I mean, and everybody you see, even on whatever news from both sides, is noticing, of course, the vigor from which each of the tribal divisive groups are getting involved. I mean, there's a lot of anger. A lot of anger. And even something as you would think it wasn't going to be that much of a deal, the whole thing around vaxxed and unvaxxed is a tribal, completely a tribal thing. And it's all a way to... I just got off a call with one of the people I work with and was talking about the oh, boy, the depth of anger that is going on in her family about vaccination, even to the point of getting boosters and the misinformation that, of course, and I'm in, and you are in the vaxxed camp, and the disinformation that we believe is disinformation is rampant. And, of course, from the other point of view, so do they. We are challenged. We are not seeing the truth. And this is with people who are not necessarily conservative or anything like that. They're in every other way. They're in the same pocket of liberal thought, shall we say. And just put it into that big, big. But on this, it got tribal. It's really amazing. Totally amazing to me. So then in the midst of it all, David called me and said, you know, I just ordered this new book from Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. We have talked a lot about it from the earliest podcast that I did with David, and we refer to him many as a time, and so do I, on my own. And a great, great teacher from the late 60s, early 70s, and he died around 80, 81, 2, 3, something like that. And controversial figure as well in
extremely.
This world. Yeah.
Extremely.
And
we should have a little codicil here. We're not going to be talking about Trungpa's life. There's a lot of controversy about that, and some of it is proven, others aren't. We've talked in the past, Rahul, about his teachings, and he was the 11th in a line of a great Tulku lineage and went to Oxford. Now, that was our fortune because not being, I'm trying not to be pro-English because I'm English, but the fact is, if you go to Oxford and you're from Tibet, you probably learn the language better than any English person. And when you hear Trungpa's speech, and I just listened to a speech he did about goodness, basic human goodness. His English was just so impeccable and easy to understand. One has to remember that that was not his original language. But because he journeyed to America via Oxford University, he learned how to translate very complex and profound concepts into perfect English. And we're very lucky to have that.
Yeah, so, not only in perfect English, but also the reality of which I don't think I've heard any other teacher's ability to translate these arcane concepts sometimes in a way that was so profoundly understandable. Just amazing. Just amazing. So David said, well, there's a new book, Cynicism and Magic, it's called. And its subtitle is Intelligence and Intuition on the Buddhist Path. And so I said, well, let's, I'm going to read it. Let's do that. And then let's talk about it. And And oh, by the way, I said it early on, we're going to do a series here. There's going to be a podcast series called Ask the Experts, David Silver and Raghu Marcus. We are the experts. We did a whole show on Jung. Now we're doing something on Trumpa. I think we've done others. And the only asterisk under which we would have to put this series is actually we know nothing whatsoever. We're just trying to grab at a few things that might help us and we could share them. Okay.
Zero, as they say in La France. We just ask us, and we'll, you know, if you want to know about the Mahabharata, we'll tell you. If you want to know about which was the absolute best Citroën to buy, the DS19 or the ID19, we know this stuff.
I didn't know you knew about Citroëns. I had a terrible accident in a Citroën just after I came back from India. I don't really know. Yeah, I rolled over in a Citroën, and because it was a Citroën, my whole family didn't die, my brother and our wives.
We're already showing this. We both know about Citroëns, which go out in the street and ask people about Citroëns.
Yeah, nobody ever heard what that is. It's a car from France, by the way. That was one of the first front-wheel drive cars.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was actually a beautiful car, futuristic. My brother had a maroon one, and we used to drive around town in it and hope that we'd become popular because of it, but it didn't seem to help that much. Okay, so...
Can I kick this off?
Yes, please do.
Because, and this is, you know, something from him that, again, trying to get this into a context that can serve us and help us without going... into and moving to Boulder, to Naropa. Well, people go to school at Naropa in Boulder, which Trungpa Rinpoche started. It's a pretty amazing place. But without having to make a giant Buddhist commitment here, so our idea is like, how do we translate this just for kind of all of us? And so here's a premise that I think everybody can recognize, okay? And I'll just read from the book. And it basically, he's talking about how we have become victims of ourselves, and we've known this for a long time. Who cannot relate with that reality? We have become victims of ourselves because basically our selfish motivations, our involvement in the what they call the kaleshas, those things which prevent us from becoming free, such as anger. He said, I don't feel that I have to convince you that spirituality is the highest and the best idea that humankind has ever come up with. I trust that you have understood this, and because of that, you want to have an experience of spirituality. We all want to have an experience that is out of this little me that we talk about all the time, and into a broader, more interconnected experience. I think we all want that, which is, he calls, the experience of spirituality. It is the case, it is so, that spirituality heightens one experience, wisdom, openness, skillfulness, and an infinite number of things. But now that we have agreed that spirituality is the highest thing, we have one big problem. A gigantic problem, an enormous problem. How are we actually going to work with such a situation? How are we going to handle this greatest gift? So that is a premise for, I don't think it limits anybody in that particular premise and how we interpret spirituality. Maybe you should talk, David, about how that would be interpreted for you.
That is a seminal statement in the book, because he's basically saying, you know, how do we do this?
Yeah.
And when he wrote about spiritual materialism in the 70s, he was basically saying two things. One is that you can't collect spiritual knowledge. You know, you're not going to get more spiritual by having more books or going to more lectures. Yes, you can certainly help yourself by practice. But once the focus is satisfactory to you, he was sort of suggesting at the time, well, you know, stay with that because it's working. But he also was saying spiritual materialism is the idea that you can avoid the basic source of Buddhist thought, which is egolessness. You can avoid egolessness by adopting some proud spiritual path, which satisfies your ego. Yeah. Now, he never says you can get rid of your ego, or it's, you know, you can't. There's no driverless cars here in this particular vehicle that we have. We are driving it. And then that's the ego, and it's its job, and it does its job relatively well. But he's saying the ego cannot be the, shall we say, the recipient of honors in the spiritual quest, because the whole point of his spiritual quest as a Tibetan Buddhist master is to rid ourselves of neurosis. He makes this point 50 times in the book. Mm-hmm. He keeps saying the natural neuroses, the hidden neuroses, the dualism that comes at birth, all of this stuff is the aim of the practice. It is not to make you, to enable you to be a better, a more spiritual CEO. No matter what, I'm not saying CEO shouldn't do, but let's not do this, because we should be past this, because that's part of the problem Raghu was discussing, we were talking about before. Ego directing opinion, directing practice, directing action with guns. And so that's obviously not the way to go. But I do believe that his cynicism is not the cynicism that we see on, you know, on the news or in sort of dark humor. It's the cynicism of belief of having to cut through the pretentiousness that the ego still presents us when we think we've left it behind, because it's still in control, because you're still enjoying the idea of being spiritual.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that cynicism is necessary to all of our practice.
It's like right cynicism. Right.
Yes.
Like right wisdom, right cynicism. Yeah, it's really
he doesn't say ever, don't do it, don't practice. He just says, don't expect, you know, unicorns, folks. Don't expect to be in the bliss meadow all the time. Because that's not reality, and it's not the reality you're living. Because if you think your reality is great, you're not thinking about your inner reality and the mechanisms and shapes of your neuroses and how you have to deal with those neuroses. So you certainly can't be a teacher or even a practitioner.
Teacher.
So he's pretty harsh about
that. Who cares about that, teacher or practitioner even? How about you can't be kind to the human being next door to you?
Right, you can't.
You can't at all have the kind of openness that it takes to allow for yourself to change and other people to. So,
right.
So he says here, before we do anything, we need to ask who we are. So it's the basic premise is, okay, we're locked into tremendous selfishness. We are locked into tremendous reactivity. And as such, we get unhappy. And once we get unhappy, we look out for how we can transform that unhappiness. It also may be not just that we're unhappy in that way. It may be that we were suddenly blown into another dimension through a piece of music, through a psychedelic, through a book, through a teacher, through anything. And then you have the realization it is possible. And that's the nature of spirituality, that the infinite possibilities of becoming free of that very limiting ego is a wonderful thought. So that's spirituality. But how do we do it? So we have to look inside to find out, well, who are we? And that's what he's talking about. Who's going to get it? What is going to get it? What is you? What is me? That is the greatest and most important question Buddha asked. The Buddha introduced this problem into human thinking to rediscover or find out whether there is anything to discover at all. Who are you? Who am I? What am I? Usually you feel that there is a quote-unquote me, quote-unquote, I am going to benefit by it, right? That's the immediate. We think that I, quote-unquote, can become a great powerful person. That has become a problem. The question we have to ask at this point is, supposing so-called you becomes enlightened, then what? of course, automatically, the answer is that you will become a Buddha, an enlightened one. You think, I will preach the law. I will proclaim my wisdom to the people. Or just walk around thinking you know everything. You know, that's something too. And Trumpa goes, there is enormous snobbishness involved with that approach, to put it lightly, and deception. You might find such snobbishness very light and harmless, but actually it is extraordinarily deadly and powerful. You are about to become an egomaniac. You are becoming an egomaniac. You think that you could become the Buddha himself and preach the law and gather all kinds of disciples and glow your halo all over the place.
Brilliant. I mean, and this is, you know, he gave this lecture in 73, something like that.
It's Naropa, really it's 74. When he actually gave this talk, when Ram Dass came, they actually thank, you know, Ram Dass for being part of it, which was the start of Naropa in the summer of 1974. And Ram Dass did the course on the Bhagavad Gita for 17 days or something. It was quite an intense thing. We have actually at the foundation, we actually have the videos of this. We're going to... I'm glad you brought it up because I got another commercial. We're going to run a course, an online course, February 2022, and it will introduce, not the whole thing because it's too long, but a beautiful honing in of his rendition of the usefulness of what the Bhagavad Gita can teach us. So that's a whole other thing.
Well, you know, he did give lectures about goodness and the basic goodness and how wonderful that is. And that's the miracle, you know. And the magic in this book is not that different. That he's basically saying, be cynical about easy answers, because no one's ever been able to have easy answers. That's why there are 84,000 sutras and 32 diamond sutras. And, you know, in that world, a great deal of practice went on in every lineage. And so he's saying practice is the answer, meditation is the answer, actually. Because, yeah. You know, inside meditation, you know, ultimately he was the ur progenitor of that, you know, which we all love with Sharon and Joseph Goldstein and all those people, incredible American people who've done wonders with something that was established by him and Naropa and other people. So what is it about? Is it just about being cynical about easy answers, Americanized, you know, sort of quick ice cream makers? No, but it's also about continuity and discontinuity. Now, I wanted to quote something here. Mm. He says, stuff is going on, even about being bored. He doesn't actually say that. I interpreted that because he says, well, when you meditate, you get bored. And then you think, well, there's nothing happening. Well, there's no God. There's no nothing. There's no other. There's no, it's just me thinking and I'm bored. And he said, wait a minute. What about the activity of being bored? What is the essence of that? That is energy. That is life. So that every discontinuous thought that you have is still life, even if it is that of doubt, fear, animosity, tribalism. It's still, he gives it energy and he says, there is some kind of continuity, which is the discontinuity that pervades the whole thing. Therefore, there is a working basis, meaning that within this discontinuity, there are possibilities of evolving spiritually, cultivating discipline, and liberating yourself from the bondage of samsara. In other words, he defines, and not just him, Buddhism defines samsara not just as being, oh, well, you know, I like to have my tea at 4, and I like to watch Oprah, and I like to drive a vintage Jaguar. Yeah, that's samsara, but he's talking about the samsara inherent in spiritual delusion. Meaning that it's very dangerous. He says it, Raghu, you said it before. It's dangerous to quickly preach stuff about sudden awarenesses, sudden nirvanas, suddenly, because it always fails you. And then you think there's nothing and you're fucked. So he's saying all the time, we are a practice, we are a teaching of practice. And, you know, I didn't really understand any of that when I was a younger person until I started hanging out with musicians. No. I'm realizing that when they went on stage, every one of them who were masters, who were really good at what they did, They'd rehearsed and played forever to get to that point. No matter how spontaneously brilliant they could be, Stephen Stills, who I really admire as a musician, said to me one time that he was always known as a sort of a rough and ready guy and didn't do anything much. He rehearsed like a devil for years, decades. And then when he was with Buffalo Springfield and later with other bands, he was able to play those beautiful, beautiful guitar lines that he did fluently and with no problem at all and very little passion, just skill. Passion because he'd spent years learning how to do it. Why would being a spiritual aspirant be any different? In other words, you have to go through the rehearsal. And that's a lot of this book is about that. It's about you actually got to do the damn practice. Some people don't. Some people wake up as tulkus. Some people are mahasiddhas.
The tulkus, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, obviously is the best example. He was 5 years old, 6 years old, gone into the monastery, trained forever. I think he has the kind of openness where he still is learning, you know. But he's another kind of being. But just back to the point about cynicism, because that's something to talk. I mean, I'm so glad this book came out because the interpretation of cynicism, my own, was so skewed and so pretty much judgmental around, like, Larry David, Curb Your Enthusiasm, the level of cynicism, right, in this guy, and it's funnier than hell. And but then I can see myself just in daily life going around, and I like to play around with becoming Larry for a moment, you know, in terms of all of the phenomena that's coming at me or that I'm interacting with, and then I start to look at that and go, yeah. Like, for instance, in what I'm talking, Ram Dass, who I tried to turn on to Larry, I've said this before, he absolutely hated it because he was so mean. He was so living in a separate reality of me land. So, I mean, which is the premise of the whole thing. But you find yourself doing the same things, maybe not as dramatically or as comically, and then you start thinking, I wonder if that's kind of an impediment to becoming whole, to not be getting caught in all of the impediments that prevent that, you know, the reaction stuff and the anger and so on and so forth. And then I started looking at when the book, I started reading the book, and he says things like, you need to understand that a basic spirituality, it's absolutely necessary to go along with that cynical attitude of questioning everything. Not necessarily, and this is the key for me, was it's not intellectual, it's not logical or metaphysical even, but experientially. Taking that approach, he says, is extremely important experientially, but it's not from the judging, cynical mind thing. This can't be real because it's this, or you're completely cutting out any intuitive understanding of something. And did you read the thing on poetry and song? That particular,
I thought that
was a fascinating chapter. I mean, it's actually at the end. This is so great because this gives an understanding when he says this is not about intellectual anything. He said when you read poetry, you shouldn't try to understand the words. Not even with the songs of Vajrayana disciples, great Buddhist teachers. Don't try to scrutinize and finger through word by word, idea by idea. The traditional way is to read the songs very quickly at first and then sit on it, not quite literally, but be with it and feel how its frame of reference affects your state of being. Just be on it, live on it, sit on it. And that is when he's talking about cynical attitude, has nothing to do with intellectual judging one thing over another. It's experiential. And then, of course, he gets into it big time in this book, saying that, yeah, you can do skydiving and it gives you a moment of transcendence, a gap, as he calls it. You can do surfing and, you know, that's all true, nature. But really, it's about very disciplined, committed relationship with meditation. And he goes into it then, right? I mean,
absolutely. Yeah, I mean, he, you know, it reminds one of Ram Dass talking to us all about his MG, his plane, his golf collection of clubs, all of that, and the various points in his evolution, particularly the stroke. Those things went down the tubes, and he eventually realized, my God, what a gift! You know, because those things, which, you know, you said, Rock, there's nothing wrong with, you know, going on hikes and doing all that. He does say in the book, however, that don't kid yourself. They're just standing in a beautiful place and enjoying the clouds and the birds and the flowers is necessarily going to be part of the essential discipline, because that is still in the realm of sensory appreciation. Nice, better than many things. But he makes the point that, again, that this is a steady thing, Buddhism. There are no instant nirvanas and there's no easy way in. You may have flashes. He talks about, okay, you're cynical because you're looking at stuff and going, I don't know whether I believe that or not. I don't even know whether I don't believe it. I don't even know now whether I do or do believe. You don't know shit. He says, we know nothing. He says, we know nothing. We're stupid. And that's his cynicism, is that we have to learn something. And in the ignorance is the energy to learn something. Because unless you know you're ignorant about something, you're not going to try and learn something. Particularly on the question, as he puts it, of hidden neuroses. That, you know, the things that drive us are frequently things we can get rid of if we only had a technique to do it. Some people go to therapists, some people take psychedelics, there are all kinds of ways of doing it. He's saying, damn it, if we just practice what the Buddha told us was easy to do, and he makes the point of saying, also, Buddha was a guy like you and me. He just was a guy on the planet, but he happened to be endowed with this cosmic vision. And therefore, you know, all these years later, we're 2,500 years later, we're looking at it and going, well, that's new. I didn't think of that before. Happens to me all the time with Buddhism. And it's like, oh, I've never thought of that before. Well, he thought about it 2,500 years ago. And millions of people from all kinds of different backgrounds have gone, wow, that's helped me understand my innards, my emotional innards. Because the book is really about that. It's really about, you know, admit that you're confused. Admit that you're bewildered. He said the very first presentiment that comes to a true seeker is bewilderment. And in certain realms, you might think that that's wrong. No, the first thing is enlightenment. No, it's not. It's bewilderment. It's like, what the fuck is going on here? I'm living on this planet. It looks nice, but they're polluting it. Nobody cares. It feels nice, but people are not eating in countries that are just poverty-stricken and stricken by wars and horrible stuff. You think, wow, what is this? Being human, that ain't that great. And then you realize the question of karma, and he goes into the karma. He goes into the fact that samsaric karma will cause all these wars, because ultimately individual hatred will grow to a Donald Trump, and then he'll be in charge of a country, and then he'll poison the whole damn country. So this is, on every level, this book is the Vajra dagger.
Cutting through.
Yeah. You know, he says that. He says, you know, you got to cut through this thing. You even, first of all, you know you have to cut, like, for instance, with me. Not that long ago, well, quite a long time, I had to stop eating sugar. And it drove me absolutely nuts. Can you imagine that? It's not a big thing, really. You know?
Oh, yes.
You know, but it drove me nuts. And then I had to give up salt. So I had neither sugar nor salt. And it made me into a baby. I was like a little baby crying. You know, because I just couldn't handle it. It was a what? I can't have a pizza and I can't have a cinnamon bun? What is the point of living? But, you know, I realized that if I didn't do those things, I'd be really quite dead by now, which might please some people, but it doesn't please me at this point. So he's saying delve, like you were saying before, Raghu. Yeah. He's saying delve. Yeah. And, you know, I went to see the Shaanxi monks chant some years ago in New York. And then the leader of the group said, we're going to finish not with a chant, but with an argument, with a debate. And then two of the monks did a typical monastery debate in the Tibetan language. We didn't understand a word of it, but we saw how virulent it was and how passionate it was, and how they literally locked swords with each other and said, no, you're wrong. That's wrong. That's rubbish. I know it's rubbish. I've learned that it's rubbish in my own direct experience. So they have these debates that are incredible. And that's kind of where Trungpa's coming from. It's like, debate with yourself. You know, find out what's really, you know, why are you so upset about that? Can you imagine? So he says, meditate. He never says, go and do therapy. Not because he's against it, but because he knows that meditation will cover that.
That's evolved, though. That has evolved since his time, actually, where Buddhist people really steeped in Buddhist practice have become therapists and so on. And are doing marvelous things that are helping people address, as you said, the neurotic stuff that can easily get spiritually bypassed, which is his thing, is spiritual materialism. You know, is of course enormously helpful. He. By the way, and here, this next thing that I wanted to bring up was actually addressing again the polarity and the tribalism. And understanding. And by the way, as far as meditation, what I understand he's saying, it's the depth of going behind all of that to look for who am I, what am I, and what is this understand our relationship. Having some Sartori experience through nature or a psychedelic or anything, a film, anything, is valid. It's completely valid. It's but the day-to-day grind and you have to have a lot of intention to move through the kind of practice on a day-to-day basis and commitment it takes to really go much deeper. And I think that's what he's saying. But so he's talking about us as an entity. Saying we have one entity, you know, that I that distinguishes absolutely everything, or one existence. So automatically brings in the question of the other. Has to. Individually does not really exist as such, he says. It is purely relative. So we call it quote, heap, unquote. That heap, it's a lot of experiences, a lot of failures, achievements, disappointments, hopes, fears, and millions and trillions of little fragments of all kinds that were put together into what we call, quote-unquote, me, and quote-unquote, life. According to the Buddha, this is the key to everything, and it does, you know, forget Buddhism, it doesn't matter. This is truth, as far as I'm concerned. According to the Buddha, quote unquote, me is a false remark. You can't call yourself me, myself, I, self, or soul, because there's no way you can point out which part is quote unquote me and which part is quote unquote not me. What is me and what is not me is uncertain and unfounded, and not because we are confused and stupid. Even the most intelligent and enlightened people couldn't figure this out, for the very fact that there's nothing to figure out. And that gets into beyond rationality. And reaching that is a lot of practice. And here's the whole spiritual materialism part. We would like to build a secure home out of our bewilderment, right? Just think of what we do day to day to support the story we tell ourselves, the identities that we have, the roles that we have is really to build a whole mechanism and a fortress that we can feel safe in. Everyone does that. And then, of course, his concept of spiritualism is about finding out that that is a false facade. And the way to find that out is to first obviously engage with these concepts and then do the experiential part of going inside oneself. We grope all over the place, not having such a thing as ourselves. Though there is a sense of flow, we make that flow itself into an entity, a false entity. That constant groping creates you and other. A sense of duality, a sense of separateness develops, which is a false notion. But that falsity seems to be much more secure than truth. Oh, God. Which has no substance and which we find somewhat overpowering. We don't want to face reality. It's too brilliant, too dazzling, too hot, too cold. We would like to compromise and make ourselves comfortable. That, to me, is the essence of it all. I mean, I see it in myself, wanting, first of all, to create this out of bewilderment and out of not knowing what is the truth and what is real and not being able to connect with that behind it all, whatever you want to call it, entity that is interconnected with everything. So it's creating facades, it's creating a castle that defends, it's creating, as he said, something that makes us feel comfy. You want to feel comfy, sit back, got the throw on, TV's on, something, internet, social media, whatever it may be, and so that we don't have to confront this. Amazing, huh? Absolutely amazing.
Yeah, it's ultimate stuff because, you know, it's funny. I found myself reading a book simultaneously with this one. I don't know how it got on my Kindle, to be honest with you. It was by a guy called Jeffrey Olson, who's just a guy, an advertising executive in Oklahoma, a Mormon. Not in Oklahoma, I'm sorry, in Utah. And he tells the story of such a happy life that he had with two beautiful boys, sons, an extraordinarily sympathetic partner, his wife, brilliant woman. And he was just as happy as a human being could be. And he trusted God in that way that that some, shall we say, real Christians do. And he was just amazed by the wonder and love of it all and how everything was taken care of. And then one day he was driving on Route 80 in Utah and took his mind off the road for a moment. And his two children were there and his wife. And just like with our President Biden, the crash was horrible and he lost his wife and his younger child and was it rolled over six times and he was upside down and it ruined him. He lost a leg, an arm, everything. It was just a nightmare of an experience in a hospital for 3 months while he only had one little boy left of his life. And I'm reading this book on my Kindle at the same time as I'm reading Cynicism and Magic and realizing that this guy, Jeffrey Olson, in those moments when tragedy happened, because you can't deny the word tragedy if you lose your children. We all know, those of us that have children, what we go through when they're sick and all that. It was a tragedy, at least in the normal sense of life. And yet, at those moments when he was at his most desperate, things came to him in the hospital. He couldn't speak. He was on he was being intubated. He couldn't eat. He couldn't do anything. His body was completely shattered. And yet, that was the time when he began to see truths beyond comfort. That's what I'm trying to get at, Raghu. I just finished the book this morning, actually. It's just, you know, it's a very simple book. It's not about any dogma. He doesn't talk at all about Christianity. What he talks about is the fact that he had the most comfortable life imaginable and felt that it was permanent, at least until death do us part. But then it all shattered into horrible shards of suffering. And then he lived a life of complete and absolute horror for months and years. And yet he recovered. And it's that the Rinpoche is talking about here. That behind it all, behind the confusion, behind the samsaric desire for comfort, Pema Chodron, one of his acolytes, talks about it all the time, the comfort zone. Beyond that, there is what we have to call Wakantanka or some name, Ram or God or Jesus or whatever. It doesn't usually work because it's sort of, in the West at any rate, it is definitely, it's a humanized version of God. You know, it's a preacher, it's a guy, it's a father who helps you, it's a this or that. Trungpa can see that and see the need for it, but he says at some point in your life, you're going to have to relate to dying and suffering. You're going to have to. You don't have any choice. That's it. Good, bad, or indifferent. You have to do it. And it won't help if you've created for yourself a false Elysium, is what I would call it. Mm-hmm. You know, a pure land just for me, that I feel comfortable. I'm in the monastery. He even says, those that go to the monastery, after a short time, they go, wow, I'm home. I'm home. Well, is it home 2 seconds, 2 microseconds after you're dead? Or is it not home? Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, the Alan Wattsian, the Ramdassian, incredible cutting through of bullshit way of describing spirituality to us in the West. Ram Dass, the absolute master of it. And it's not surprising to me that Ram Dass and Trungpa were sort of doing the same thing at the same time, certainly in Europa and elsewhere, because they both said constantly, it's there for the asking, but it's not there for the imagining. It's not there because you just want it. You have to want it, but you must work for it. And what does that mean? I don't want to sound like some Puritan, but I've learned in my life, and I'm pretty old, that before I was meditating, I was all over the damn place. And then after I was meditating, I was all over the damn place in another place. and that's, you know, I'd like to read a thing. Let's see. Because he says, and you've talked about this, Raghu, in many podcasts, and I love the expression, the gap, you know, the gap that comes. Yeah. You know? And his quote about the gap is this. The gap is extremely powerful and important. The gap also cuts the notion of rebirth. So you don't come back by the power of karmic force. Physical rebirth, the process of dying and being reborn again, is the same process as your everyday life situation. Your first breath is dead and your second breath is being born. You live your life that way. There is constant birth and death taking place. After you die, there is a sense of fear because all of you've lost everything, your body, your relatives, all of your possessions. And then he says, the clumsiness of having a body is followed by a sense of relief. And finally, by a feeling of being completely lost and looking for a new body and a new situation. In this bardo we're living in now, the human life bardo, your future parents can be seen. Can be seen. And he's talking about that bardo. In this bardo, we can prepare for how to deal with that bardo. And, you know, that becomes real when you're 77 years old, I'll tell you.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I don't want to come ageist, but I have reverse ageism. I didn't know shit until I was, I don't know, last week. and then I didn't learn that, and then I learned it and forgot it. Okay.
Last week.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Oh, I wanted to just quote him too around the spiritual materialism. Spiritual materialism, or, you know, the way that we talked about spiritual bypass is very, very similar. It's a spiritual bypass being a more recent term. But the way that we fool ourselves, you know, is writ large in all of our lives. And I think one you would probably say, well, one thing that's happened getting older and being a little bit wiser is absolutely not believing in any of the shit that goes through my head.
Yes.
And not reacting that way and not copping into you know, bringing more stuff, so to speak, into the fortress. What did you call your fortress? It had a foreign name to it. What was that?
I called it another name. I don't know.
Elysium?
Elysium, yeah. Elysium. I pronounced it wrong. You know, the Greek paradise, pure land.
Elysium. You can know, you spell it? Because I think
Elysium. Elysium.
Elysium.
Shakespeare speaks about it quite frequently. Midsummer Night's Dream is an ironic version of Elysium. And it's idyllic. It's perfect. It's what the, you know, in the Hindu tradition, I believe, is called demigodness, you know, which is fabulous, and you enjoy it. It's lovely. And it's all good, all good food and great looking people and everything. But it's samsara. It's another form of samsara. It's bloody difficult, this stuff. Yeah, it's very difficult. I wouldn't mind a little couple of million years in a demigod state. You know?
Especially
I'll take
after
it.
This.
I'll take it.
Really.
I'll take it.
All right. So he said, beware of spiritual materialism. Because when we create more trips and tricks in our lives, we are creating all kinds of garbage. Some of the tricks are fantastic, outrageous. And one might wonder who even dreamt up such things. One feels dwarfed by such wisdom. However, it's just more stuff. It's garbage. It's something that's been imposed upon us, which has nothing to do with unlearning, undoing, or simplifying. It's all piling up boxes on boxes. We buy this stuff and we save the cardboard boxes until finally our garage is completely filled with boxes. Boxes and boxes with labels on them. And that is the, so this book is the big debunker of the way in which we collect, so in order to protect ourselves even further, in order to build a world which we can believe in as a separate entity. This book is the antidote
yeah.
to that kind of perspective, which every one of us carries along in one way or the other. I don't care who you are, unless you have gone beyond polarity inside yourself. And then, yeah, that's it. You know.
Yeah, what's funny about this book is that it's sort of like 7/8 of it are about the cutting sword of cynicism, the necessary cynicism mm-hmm. in order to grow. And the other 1/8 is about magic. And I know that the way the editors did this, and probably the way he did it in the lecture, was quite deliberate. That he ultimately is saying the same thing about magic that is embedded or embodied in the phrase miracle of love. That one of the greatest teachings I ever had was from Ram Dass Maharaji via Ram Dass about miracles are great and everything, but the biggest miracle of all is how we are interdependent and there is such a thing as love throughout the universe. And that magic is what he's talking about. He's talking about you finally become a human being, not you finally become a bodhisattva necessarily, but in the last chapter he says this whole business is not to edify and to sit on the throne of perfect spiritual understanding and progressions. It is to become that human being that you actually are. And that is magic. That transformation is really magic.
Not the miracles and all that other stuff.
That's right. Exactly. And it's the same thing as Ram Dass and Jack and all the great people that are in, that I might do a little ad here, in Love, Serve, Remember Foundation, is that they're all very different and there are nuances, incredible nuances between them, but they all kind of concur with that, you know. And yet, you know, I'll do a quote here. You know, all of this goes away and all your gods go away and all your shibboleths go away too, and it all goes away. And then, wow, you're bewildered again. He says, within the state of vagueness and uncertainty, there is very strong energy. Something very powerful is taking place. Something is happening. There's a shock, an electricity of being pulled back into the present constantly. Here, here, here. It's happening. It's really taking place. It's not as vague as we expected, but actually it's happening. And this is the way this man spoke. I mean, he just spoke with these kind of rhythms and like a musician almost, that he would convince you. And Ram Dass did this even more in a way that, you know, that little thing that I just read, it just made me so happy in a way, because it's like, okay, what is the essence of this thing he's saying? Well, it's certainly the basic goodness of organic life, no matter what, even if it's the viper eating the frog. Whatever it is that is the essence of our environment, both on this level and on any other level that we aspire to, is that fact that something is happening and it's a shock to us because we've tried to obliterate our deepest need, which is to find out who we are and why we're here, instead of which America is the pinnacle of comfort. He says somewhere in this book, Raghu, he was talking about a cool cigarettes ad in the 70s. And he said he saw this ad on TV saying, you know, if you have the cool cigarette, you're going to be cool. Not only a cool person, but they're not hot and they'll be good for you. Doctors smoke them. And he calls it, Trungpa calls it the lowest bottom of samsara. The lowest bottom of samsara. Meaning it doesn't get worse than this in terms of our deception, our self-deception. Mm. We lie about a product. then we want the product, then we find the product, well, accidentally kills you. Yeah. You know, I mean, I love this book. I'm so glad you let us do this, Raghu, because it's I think people should buy it. First of all, you should support Shambhala, great publishers. And
yeah,
I just love
really
them.
They are,
and you know, and this book
we have to. Go ahead. You were going to say.
Well, just you know, reading this book is not the easiest thing in the world because it doesn't give you. It doesn't give you cakes and ale, as Shakespeare said. It doesn't give you cakes and ale. It gives you, you know, bitter, sweet things, which are that you've got to let go of some of these comfort zones. It's very, very hard. I love comfort. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't like discomfort. Who does? But when you read Minjur Rinpoche's book, when he deliberately made himself incredibly uncomfortable.
Dying uncomfortable. You know?
And he did it. And he's anybody who's ever seen him or read anything by him knows that this guy is the real shit, And he talks about that particular consciousness that comes from dropping all concept of individual ego and necessary comfort. And I know if it were me listening to this, I might say, well, I like it when my friend says, I like that thing you wrote, or I like your house, it's comfortable. We're all like this. What he's trying to say is that we're all like this. And that in order to advance into a more cosmic sort of consciousness, one cannot do it by just impulse alone.
Yeah, right. And he just completely turns one's head around perspective-wise. And it makes you think and it makes you understand. It doesn't make you. It allows one to understand a little bit more of what the reasoning is to go and actually spend some time going inside, no matter how much it is. And even in the beginning, few minutes of this is as important as, in the end, hopefully, one's ability to actually go on a retreat and do many hours of practice. And I'm really happy with this too, Dave. So this, and as part of our Ask the Experts, David Silver and Raghu Marcus, I'm sure we can answer any of your questions that come in on this material, or even, you know, get the book and then, you know, we should do, this would be really fun. We should do a live podcast interacting with people who have read the book and having a discussion online with people.
Well, you know, the book does have questions and answers within it, of course.
Oh, yeah, it has that too, yes, with Trump.
Which is always great. You know, I think it's a good thing to ask the experts, because then in terms of Trumpist philosophy, you will then know how deeply desperate and injured you are. Because, you know, if you are indeed asking Raghu Marcus and David Silver about anything, you're likely to run into deep deception.
We represent each one of us, and that's the reality, and that's why we're doing this Ask the Experts.
But I mean, I want to do another ad for you. I want to do an ad, which is that, you know, given that this foundation, you know, Ram Dass's centrality to it, alive or past, and the ways in which other people within it, like Christian Dass and Jack Kornfeld and Sharon and Trudy and all these great people, the way they talk is within these parameters of non-deception, either within or not with spiritual progress. Mm-hmm. And that Raghu is the king of this, in the sense that, I don't mean in terms of power, but I've known him a long time, and it's good to have someone running something so important and useful who isn't, who has not based his spiritual practice upon a kind of
knowing
deception.
Knowing
something. It's more like, Trump says in this book, and Roger's good at this, and a lot of those people are that I mentioned, it's undoing, it's not doing.
Yeah. Well, that's just a truism for sure. Thank you. That's lovely comments. And I'll send you the money later.
Thank you, I need it.
Yes. Thanks for being here, though. God, I love it when you're able to have time to do this.
You are the busy one. You're the busy one.
No, this is more important to me than anything, just to be able to have an outlet like this, you know.
No, it's great.
And it's really great. So thank you, David, for being here, everybody. This is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com. And I did mention Madison Margolin will be doing a psychedelic podcast. And please just go to BeHereNowNetwork.com. Get on the mailing list. You'll get an idea of when these podcasts are coming out and the featured ones. And Ramdas.org, of course, for all of the offerings there. We just did a big Be Here Now celebration at Wisdome. And we're going to be live streaming. We're going to Maui and actually going to do the first retreat without Ramdas, which is kind of exciting and a little bit sort of scary at the same time. I don't know why. It's just more human stuff. And by the way, we are all human, so let's remember that. Jack Kornfield's wonderful thing. It's okay. We're human. It's okay. You know?
Yeah. And that seems to be okay. Yeah,
that seems to be okay. And so we're all doing the best we can to support each other. See you next week on Mind Rolling, David. We'll see you soon.
Thanks. Great chat. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.